This is the Disability News Program. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Welcome to the program. On the show today, I'll be reading a number of stories related to disability issues, including a piece from the New York Times about oral argument in the U.S. Supreme Court in an important case dealing with the rights of disabled students. I'll be reading a piece from the Arizona Mirror about the resolution of the political dispute in the Arizona legislature regarding funding for disability services, and an article from Popular Mechanics about experiments using gold to help restore vision. I'll be covering a number of other articles of interest as well. First up is a piece from Georgetown University's The Georgetown Voice, entitled "Georgetown Becomes Second Top 25 University to Offer a Disability Studies Major," by Elaine Clark and Connor Dwin, published April 27, 2025. After years of advocacy for those involved in Georgetown's Disability Studies program, the university will now offer a Disability Studies major, according to an April 15 announcement. Students in the College of Arts and Sciences can declare the major starting fall 2025. English professor Libby Rifkin founded the Disability Studies minor in 2017, and those involved in the program have been working to expand the offerings since. About 2 or 3 years ago, many students started saying, "Why can't we have a major?" Pediatrics professor Toby Long, a faculty member of the Disabled Studies program since its inception, said, "So we started looking into it and doing some investigations of other universities that have a major, and there's not very many of them." After several years of work, Georgetown will become the second top 25 university to offer a major program dedicated to disability studies this fall. There are very few non-professional liberal arts interdisciplinary disability studies majors like the one that we have now at Georgetown, Professor Quill Kukla, director of the Disability Studies program from 2022 to 2024, said. "We felt like we had the opportunity to do something very cutting edge." According to Kukla, the minor's success inspired the major, and both will serve as integral parts of the program going forward. "A lot of people want to attach the minor onto a pre-med program or a pre-law program or something like that, which doesn't really give them room for a whole other major. So our minor is still extremely important," they said. "But for people who really are looking for a career in or near disability studies itself, or something that has to do directly with disability, the major is going to be a really good option." The Disability Studies major is designed for students pursuing a variety of career paths, including academia, health policy, occupational therapy, social work, and health and disability law. Long said that the expansion of the program into a major will open up space for students to do more in-depth study and scholarship around disability, as well as provide further opportunities for internships and research with faculty. "There are many faculty throughout the campus that work in areas related to disability that would be fabulous opportunities for the undergraduates to work with and explore issues. Some issues that may not, at first blush, be affected by or affect people with disabilities," Long said. "Students and faculty recognize that disability intersects with other fields of study and aspects of life, such as law, culture, medicine, art, and more. For this reason, it's critical that the program is robust," according to Paige Benish, who is considering a disability studies minor. "Disability is such a facet of human life, and it's so misunderstood and stigmatized by society," Benish said. "It's really exciting that some people are going to use their undergraduate time to become experts in that and hopefully influence the world for the better based on the perspectives they get." Professors are also excited to see the program expand after years of advocacy from faculty and students, according to Theodora Danlevich, an English professor who teaches disability studies classes. I think disability studies is a very valuable perspective that informs virtually all struggles towards justice, because the orientation towards disabled experiences helps us to really hone in on fundamental ways in which structures and systems need to be reassessed and reimagined, she said. The disability studies major fits well with Georgetown's values, such as cura personalis, Kukla said. A major that really emphasized thinking about how people have diverse bodies and minds and perspectives and are enmeshed in networks of care and vulnerability and dependency and strength and so forth was just a really good fit with what Georgetown claims to value, they said. Long echoed Kukla's sentiment. It's a perfect place to have an academic unit that investigates disability, not as an impairment, but as a component of the life course, Long said. Banish is excited for the new major, but emphasized the importance of the Disability Studies program remaining centered around the leadership and experiences of disabled people. According to Kukla, many but not all of the current faculty have disabilities. I see a potential scenario where we have the disability studies major in place, but we lose leadership of disabled people, and then it becomes, oh, we're studying about disabled people, they said. Banish added that disabled experiences are not a monolith and hopes that the program is careful not to teach it that way, especially when non-disabled professors teaching courses about the disability. In general, disability is such a dynamic, versatile thing that different people go through wildly different stuff. And so, even as someone who's been disabled my almost entire life, I don't experience everything, and I don't have the authority to talk about everything, they said. Despite this caution, Banish emphasized that they are still excited about how the growth of the program could allow others to better understand the perspectives of disabled people. Kukla believes that disability studies growth into a major will bring it deserved attention in the academic world, which is especially important for a subject focusing on diversity that exists on campus. A lot of our faculty, not all, but a lot of our faculty, are disabled, and a lot of our students are disabled, they said. It's a place where disabled community members are fully contributing to the intellectual life of the university, which I think is really exciting. This next article comes from the Washington Post. It's entitled, "These autistic people struggled to make sense of others. Then they found AI." For people living with autism, experiencing awkward or confusing social interactions can be a common occurrence. Autistic Translator claims to help some people make sense of their social mishaps. Published April 27, 2025 by Andrea Jimenez, San Francisco. Theron Pierce has never held a job long enough to get promoted and struggles to connect with people at work. 10 months into a gig teaching cello lessons at an after-school program in Canada, Pierce felt like they were thriving in the job. Then a layoff notice came. Embarrassed and hurt, 34-year-old Pierce, who has autism, said they struggled to understand why they'd been let go. So they turned to Autistic Translator, an AI tool where you type in a situation you're trying to understand, and it gives the unspoken nuances of social situations. After describing their situation, the translator generated a response. In bullet points, the AI told Pierce how their persistent questions and search for feedback was interpreted by their supervisors as incompetence. "It was kind of eye-opening for me," Pierce said. Reading feedback from an AI devoid of any human expression or emotion made the information easier to process, Pierce said. More than 2% of adults, or over 5 million people, have been diagnosed with autism in the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and medical and research experts say they typically struggle to grasp unspoken rules and guidelines, resulting in confusing or awkward social interactions. AI tools like Autistic Translator or Goblin tools claim to help people like Pierce better understand social situations. Some autism researchers have found reasons to be optimistic about AI's value, saying it can be a great companion to other therapeutic tools. But many experts and users agree that these AI tools, helpful as they are, still need a lot of work. Autistic Translator and similar tools are especially helpful for people with autism because those people generally think in terms of rules, says Elizabeth Laugesen, clinical professor and director of UCLA's Program for the Education and Enrichment of Relational Skills, who works with autistic individuals to develop social skills and maintain relationships. The tools can help users confirm their comprehension of an interaction or event. But Laugesen remains cautious about AI's use beyond general yes or no prompts. That's because AI doesn't understand the social nuances, context, or conversational patterns needed to provide accurate and helpful responses. If we have an over-reliance on an AI to navigate the social situation, then we might also be discouraging things like self-advocacy or personalized support, which we know are really critical for their growth and for independence, Laugesen said. Autistic Translator was built using advice from therapists, and the bot generates answers based on published scientific research and responses in online forums about autism. Its founder, Michael Daniel, who has autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, says its instant responses make the AI chatbot helpful and popular among users. I found it really took the emotional sting out of the situation and helped process through those things much faster than I normally would have, Daniel said in an interview. The 34-year-old created Autistic Translator from his home in Newcastle, Australia, after losing his job in August. Daniel, who also has a daughter with autism and a son with ADHD, said living in a home with different neurotypes made communicating hard. If he could use AI to communicate at work, he could use it to do the same at home, he thought. Daniel released the AI tool to the public via a Reddit post, garnering thousands of positive interactions overnight. Using his background as a data analyst, Daniel built the translator using OpenAI's ChatGPT models. Today, he says it has more than 3,000 downloads, and it costs $4 to $12 a month, depending on the tier. Since then, Daniel made the service into an app called NeuroTranslator and expanded its translation capabilities to users with ADHD. There are other tools that claim to help neurodiverse people. Bram DeBeyser created Goblin Tools, a website that offers 8 different AI tools geared for all neurotypes. Users can ask questions or put down their scrambled thoughts into different AI tools to mitigate tasks such as creating to-do lists, mapping out tasks, and weighing pros and cons. While Goblin Tools doesn't translate social situations, tools like the Formalizer help users convey their thoughts in the way they want it to come across to avoid miscommunication. AI tools are particularly popular among people on the autism spectrum because, unlike humans, AI never gets tired of answering questions, DeBizer said in an interview. They don't tire, they don't get frustrated, and they don't judge the user for asking anything that a neurotypical might consider weird or out of place, he said. Lawrence Fung, an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Stanford University, said Autistic Translator can be a great tool to improve communication and help people articulate what is going on in social settings. I think that they can definitely learn from it, Fung said. However, people with autism don't always get the whole picture, and because the AI is reliant on the user's understanding of the situation, it can result in inaccurate outputs, Fung said. For 22-year-old Eva Dale, understanding the entire picture of certain social situations can be a challenge. The bakery worker from Connecticut often finds that people say one thing when they really mean another. Deciphering what people mean isn't intuitive for Dale, who has autism and relies on direct translations from her mom. During one instance, Dale's grandmother mentioned multiple times that her dog needed to go out, meaning it needed to be walked, but Dale literally interpreted it to take the dog outside. Later, Dale's mom explained that her grandmother was really asking her to walk the dog. A lot of times, people say something like, the dog has to go out, and it means a secret message like, will you take the dog out? They won't tell you the secret message and expect you to know it, Dale said. Skeptical, Dale entered the interaction into Autistic Translator. To her surprise, she got the same response her mom had given her. I feel like the program understands at least somewhat the autistic brain in general. It's actually very impressive that it can understand such a wide range of people, she said. However, not all users get direct answers. After coming across Autistic Translator on Reddit, Philip Lee, a 28-year-old from California, tested out the AI tool on multiple occasions, but decided he'd prefer to get feedback from the people around him. Understanding tone, social cues, and other nonverbal language has always been a challenge for Lee, who has autism and ADHD. He was reprimanded last year by his graduate program committee for delivering jokes at inappropriate times. He also heard from his peers and colleagues that his blunt tone and lack of eye contact came off as dismissive. Frustrated, Lee sought to better understand his cognitive difference. Asking the translator how people perceive his mannerisms helped Lee clarify some things, like when he asked AI, "Why do people get mad when I don't smile?" The translator responded, "Neurotypicals often rely on smiles as a nonverbal cue for friendliness, while this might not be a natural expression for autistics." This made sense to Lee, as he entered more specific scenarios from his personal life, such as, "Why do I get so angry?" The responses grew more vague and general. Sometimes there was no response because of the complicated nature of the questions. Daniel said that users are given a disclaimer about the translator's capabilities and that people don't have to agree with everything the AI tool says. Autistic Translator is programmed to acknowledge and redirect any questions about complex topics such as violence, drugs, and medical advice, and divert back to communication. Wary of the AI's ability to factor in the context and dynamics of his life, Lee now prefers to hear feedback directly from his colleagues and family. It's informational but not holistic enough to suffice as a solution for everything, Lee said of the AI tool. There is no roadmap nor a flowchart, because the autistic experience is an individualized experience that requires so much time and patience. As for Pierce, the translator recently helped them navigate a tricky relationship question. Seeing the feedback reassured Pierce that they were reading the situation correctly and gave them confidence to start a conversation with their friend. That rarely happens to me, feeling prepared for a conversation, Pierce said. The response from the AI made me feel validated and relieved. Next up, from the Tucson Sentinel, a piece that originally appeared in the Arizona Mirror, entitled Disability Funding Crisis Averted as Hobbs Signs Bipartisan $122 Million Rescue Package. Parents who fought for months celebrate victory but remain unsettled by political battles. By Caitlin Sievers, posted April 25th, 2025. Arizona's developmentally disabled community breathed a collective sigh of relief Thursday as a bipartisan solution to an impending budget cliff was finally signed into law. The agreement to supply the Division of Developmental Disabilities with $122 million in supplemental funding to get it through the end of the fiscal year passed through the State House of Representatives Wednesday evening and was approved by the Senate on Thursday. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs signed the bill into law Thursday afternoon. Kathleen Muldoon's 11-year-old son, who has cerebral palsy and is blind and deaf, relies on DDD services. She said she ran around her house in celebration after the vote on Wednesday. Muldoon is a mother of three and a full-time medical school professor, but still trudged to the Capitol twice a week for the past few months to fight for the developmentally disabled community. I feel relieved and I also feel unsettled, she told the Arizona Mirror. The approval of House Bill 2945 came after months of political fighting and accusations between the Republicans, who control both chambers of the legislature, and Hobbs, who they accused of causing the funding gap through fiscal mismanagement. The bill headed to her desk after bipartisan votes of 48-11 in the House and 28-1 in the Senate, with only Republicans, most of them members of the far-right Arizona Freedom Caucus, voting against it. Legislators who are constitutionally responsible for funding the state government have had since January to negotiate a supplemental funding bill, but they fought for months to come to a solution that would get through both chambers without getting a veto from Hobbs. Muldoon and Michelle Thorne, co-founder of the advocacy organization Care for the Caregivers, both said they were thankful for support from the community and for the legislators who worked behind the scenes to make sure they didn't face devastating service cuts. But they're also walking away from the last couple of months of intense advocacy at the Capitol with resentment for the political showmanship that some Republicans displayed throughout the process. I hope that, in the future, if they want to have negotiations with us, that they actually do it in good faith and they don't play politics with this community ever again, Thorne said. The funding bill takes effect immediately because it had emergency language and passed with a two-thirds majority in both chambers, allowing it to bypass the normal 90-day delay from signature to implementation. Getting that supermajority on board was crucial since DDD was expected to run out of money May 1st, meaning that the nearly 60,000 Arizonans with conditions like cerebral palsy, autism, and other developmental disabilities would lose access to services they depend on. The Parents as Paid Caregivers program, which was responsible for the majority of DDD's budget deficit, trains parents and then pays them to provide in-home care to their own children, instead of third-party caregivers, but only if they require extraordinary care above and beyond typical parenting tasks. The PPCG program expanded over the last year from about 3,000 participants to around 6,000, even after Republicans in the legislature refused to provide specific funding for it. They accused Hobbs of executive overreach for allowing the program to balloon without the necessary funding to pay for it. In the end, the final version of the funding bill that passed through both chambers included the $122 million that Democrats and advocates had begged for to keep DDD solvent, but it also places tighter restrictions on the PPCG program. And the bill allocates $355,000 for a special audit of the program, something the Republicans pushed for to ensure that parents aren't abusing it. Muldoon said that some House Republicans treated the parents who use PPCG like they were draining money from society, even though many of those parents had to quit their jobs to provide full-time care for their children. Muldoon was struck by House Republicans' decisions to walk out of the chamber while DDD parents shared their personal stories last month. Thorne agreed that GOP legislators' efforts to block advocates for the disabled community from sharing how proposed cuts to the PPCG program would impact them was distressing. I was shocked by the lengths that, especially the House, went through to silence the caregivers and to ensure for a very long time that we didn't have a voice in the hearings, Thorne said. And she thinks there's a simple explanation for House Republicans' repeated refusal to allow the advocates to speak during public hearings, where they discussed their gap funding proposals. The optics wouldn't be good for them. They would have looked really bad, Thorne said. Our stories are impactful. The way we live our lives does make an impact and motivates people to act for the right reasons. After voting to pass the gap funding bill, legislators from both parties thanked one another for their efforts to finally come together to reach a solution that didn't leave the DDD community in crisis. But Thorne said she wasn't buying the warm sentiments that some of the legislators expressed for those who rely on PPCG. Particularly disingenuous, Thorne said, were what she called a victory lap from Republican Representatives Matt Gress and David Livingston, who had spent months pushing for cuts to the program. Thorne and Muldoon both said that Representatives Nancy Gutierrez, a Democrat, and Julie Willoughby, a Republican, are the legislators who deserve praise for working behind the scenes to ensure that a compromise was reached. I think she's a really brave person, Muldoon said of Willoughby, who took a stand against her own party last week when they pushed to cut the PPCG program in half, risking her own political career in the process. Both advocates also reserved praise for all of the members of the developmental disability community and their supporters for their constant presence at the Capitol to push lawmakers to do the right thing. I'm so proud of our community, Muldoon said. But even though they seem to have won this battle, it hasn't been without consequences. Many families lost nurses and outside caregivers as the deadline to fund DDD got closer and closer, and those workers sought jobs with a more certain future. We really need to look inward. We really need to do better. This entire process was a disaster, Democratic Senator Annalise Ortiz of Phoenix said Thursday morning before voting for the gap funding bill. Next up, we'll hear a first-person commentary about that budget battle by Amy Haley. This appeared in the Arizona Mirror and is entitled, "The Women Are Going to Get This Done, How Bipartisanship Saved Disability Services, How a Seventh Grader's Email Opened Doors When Arizona's Most Vulnerable Families Needed It Most." But before we hear that article, I want to remind you that this is the Disability News Program. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. And now that piece by Amy Haley that appeared April 28, 2025, in the Arizona Mirror. It was the first time I had put on pumps in almost 10 years. You see, when my twins turned 3, I had to say goodbye to my corporate job, to a career I had put so much of myself into. My medically fragile and behaviorally complex son needed me at home. So in February, a decade after I traded those pumps and suits for syringes and feeding tubes, I reached back to the dark recesses of my closet and my past life. I found those uncomfortable high heels, and I took out my messy bun, It was time to bring back that confidence I had lost many hospital hallways ago and bring it to our Arizona legislature. Something was swirling there, and my son needed me in a very new way. When I first heard that the majority party in our state legislature was questioning the validity of the support Arizona had been providing its disabled population, I honestly thought it was just a miscommunication. I thought, certainly we could clear things up with facts. My son had been sicker than normal, so I couldn't give much, but in the long run, the time I could offer would be worth it. What I actually found in those early weeks trying to reach my Republican legislators was slammed doors. That is, until my seventh grade daughter Grace decided she had a part to play for her twin brother, too. I didn't know she had emailed our District 13 representative, Julie Willoughby, to ask for a meeting, and when I found out, I definitely didn't expect a response. Grace had asked Representative Willoughby if it wasn't too much trouble, could her mommy, her nana, and her brother in a wheelchair come too? And Willoughby opened her door. In March, I pulled out those pumps again and loaded up the wheelchair van for another family trip to the Capitol. Both of my children have something to say, though only one of them can use words. Caleb's language exists in subtlety, gestures, squeals, facial expressions, even self-injury. We watch him constantly, afraid to miss a need, a want, a pain, or a warning sign. But Grace? Grace has no shortage of words. For 13 years, she's believed that she can feel what her brother wants to say. So, I let her take the lead that day. We all sat in a big room on the third floor of the House of Representatives, and I asked if she could run the meeting. It was hers, after all. With a nod of approval from Willoughby, Grace began. She asked about Willoughby's job as a trauma nurse, news to me, about her role as majority whip, and yes, I too was curious whether whips were involved, and eventually about how committee chairmen are chosen. Her line of questioning had purpose. She'd been at a House Appropriations Committee meeting in February and had not been impressed. She had seen two men, Chairman David Livingston and Vice Chairman Matt Gress, wield power with little compassion or understanding, talking down to constituents who were clearly fearful and desperate. To her seventh grade mind, the House of Representatives was as much hers as anyone's. She saw injustice and she brought her questions. And Willoughby? She met Grace's sincerity with grace of her own. She took her seriously. She answered every question with dignity and depth. I sat back, overwhelmed. Watching my daughter volley with a legislator with respect and poise, and watching that legislator return it in kind, was almost too much. I wasn't just proud of Grace, I was proud of Willoughby. Then it was my turn. And I had two choices, fall into the beauty of what had just happened and try to be Willoughby's new bestie, or stand up and ask the hard questions. My natural tendency, what had pulled me away from journalism years ago, was to choose the former. I like people. I want to be liked. But by the grace of God, I found a middle. I chose honesty with empathy. I asked what we could do to bridge the divide. I answered Willoughby's questions with facts. I gently challenged misinformation. I offered insight into the painful, often overwhelming life of a family raising a medically complex child. And she listened, not defensively, not dismissively, with curiosity and compassion. We ended that day with an invitation for Grace and her friends to return for a field trip. I sent a follow-up email the next day, and then I waited. At the same time, I had been given the opportunity to build some relationships with Democratic representatives who were strongly supporting clean funding for the disability community. I was invited to a roundtable with Governor Katie Hobbs and several other Democrats, and I brought Caleb and Grace and Caleb's nurse along with me. In that room, Grace felt an overwhelming calling to share her heart, and so she read a speech she had written. She spoke of utopian ideals that we still should strive for, coming together, checking our egos, apologizing. While genuinely thanking them, she also called out the Democrats for not showing up to be our voice where we were stifled, and she told them there is no champion and no enemy in this story. We all needed each other. That night, one Democratic representative latched onto those words from my newly minted teenager. Representative Nancy Gutierrez promised Grace she had heard her, and she would do her best to reach across the aisle. Then came the blow. 2 weeks after our first meeting with Willoughby, Livingston dropped a cruel bill, stripping expert oversight, granting full legislative control over crucial Medicaid waiver amendments, and slowly dismantling the Parents as Paid Caregivers program that is a lifeline in the massive caregiver shortage this community is facing. It felt like a deliberate dismantling of hope. But Willoughby opened her door again. She valued my willingness to compromise and my tendency toward fact over emotion. When we sat down, she came ready to listen. She didn't waver in her support for her party, but she had questions. She wanted to understand. She debated respectfully. She was willing to learn. Over the next several days, I was invited into other meetings, never bipartisan, but I had a strong sense that there was hope for a bridge and that maybe I could play a part in closing the divide. Shortly after, Willoughby authored an amendment that proved she was listening. Thoughtful and grounded in reality, it was a meaningful attempt to protect our families while addressing her party's concerns. The night before the committee meeting, Willoughby realized she needed bipartisan support. And that's when I reached out to Gutierrez. Her promise to my daughter gave me hope that she too could see the value in effective and safe compromise that could lead to a bridge in this ever-widening gap. Gutierrez hadn't helped write the amendment, but when she read it, she was willing to support it. This was her moment to be our voice, and she was prepared to do it, even though it wasn't perfect. But then, in a move that was stunning and devastating, Livingston and Gress stacked the committee with three new Republicans minutes before the vote, just to ensure that the amendment would fail. And it did. But Willoughby didn't back down. When she spoke that day, she made it clear this was her hill, one of life and dignity, and she was willing to die on it. Let that sink in. Why should a bipartisan solution ever be a hill to die on? The following week, when another cruel amendment failed in the House, something shifted. That night, both Willoughby and Gutierrez reached out to me separately to say they'd finally connected. My heart exploded. Hope finally felt realistic. I turned to Grace and said, "They met." She screamed, "The women are going to get this done." A few hours later, she was proven right. They had come together at last, not in defiance of their roles, but with mutual respect and a shared commitment to doing what was right. Eventually, this bipartisan amendment passed. The names on it weren't Willoughby's or Gutierrez's, because, unsurprisingly, these women chose not to seek credit. I wasn't at the Capitol when the bill passed, but I know in my heart what happened in that room, just like what happened for all of us watching from home. Families who had been holding their breath for months, marching and meeting and begging for help, finally exhaled. So I get to put on those scuffed-up pumps one more time to celebrate a door opened and hands reaching across the aisle to recognize the disability community as a valued part of this state's priorities. I will walk my children through those halls one more time, and I'll remind them, this place belongs to you too. Look at what can be done when you don't give up on the value of your voices. Your life is worth fighting for, and a seventh grade girl has the power to remind all of us what courage looks like. Because in a world so quick to divide, three ladies, one red, one blue, and one still believing in the power of shades of purple, chose to meet in the middle. And that is where hope begins. Next up, we have from Popular Mechanics an article entitled, "Scientists May Have Discovered a Possible Treatment for Blindness, Gold." A new study shows that tiny gold particles could circumvent damaged photoreceptors in patients with macular degeneration and help restore their vision. By Darren Orff, published April 29, 2025. The term GoldenEye once only described spy thrillers and waterfowl, but soon it could mean groundbreaking therapy for people with failing vision. Scientists at Brown University injected gold nanoparticles into the retinas of laboratory mice and successfully restored vision in those with retinal disorders like macular degeneration. The researchers see this breakthrough as the basis for a possible prosthesis for those with retinal disorders, though it would require wearing a small laser device embedded in a pair of sunglasses or goggles. The results of the study were published in the journal ACS Nano. At first glance, the method may seem counterintuitive. How does injecting a minuscule amount of soft metal repair damaged photoreceptors in patients with macular degeneration? Well, instead of letting the eyes rely on rods and cones for vision, this method uses gold nanoparticles and laser light to stimulate bipolar and ganglion cells that are further up on the visual chain, according to the researchers. These cells typically interpret the signals made by the photoreceptors and send them to the brain. This gold-tinted technique bypasses those photoreceptors by focusing infrared light directly on the nanoparticles, which in turn generate heat that activates the bipolar and ganglion cells. This is particularly valuable for the millions of patients with macular degeneration or retinitis pigmentosa. Those diseases leave those further up cells unscathed, so this stimulation technique could improve sight overall. This is a new type of retinal prosthesis that has the potential to restore vision lost to retinal degeneration without requiring any kind of complicated surgery or genetic modification, Jeru Nai, lead author on the study, said in a press statement. We believe this technique could potentially transform treatment paradigms for retinal degenerative conditions. Nye and her team tested this process on mice and, by using probes to analyze increased activity of the visual cortices, confirmed that there was at least partial restoration of vision. Additionally, the team confirmed that the nanoparticles and laser stimulation caused no adverse side effects by searching for markers of inflammation or toxicity. To transfer this tech to humans, the researchers imagine using a pair of glasses or goggles capable of capturing data from the surrounding environment and driving the infrared laser pattern. Once these laser pulses stimulated the nanoparticles in the eyes, those laser patterns would be interpreted by the brain. Currently, the Food and Drug Administration has given the go-ahead on a similar intervention that relies on electrodes surgically implanted in the eye. However, Nye said that this technique would be much less invasive and could even provide increased resolution as the nanoparticle solution covers the entire retina. Throughout human history, gold has been one of the Earth's most precious metals, but for those struggling with retinal disorders, it could very well be priceless. Next up, from the New York Times, an article entitled, Justices Appear Skeptical of School District in Student Disability Rights Case. The case is being watched closely by disability rights groups, which warned that arguments by a school district could threaten broader protections for disabled people. By Abby Van Sickle, published April 28, 2025. The Supreme Court appeared skeptical on Monday of a Minnesota school district's argument that students with disabilities must prove their school acted in bad faith in failing to provide adequate accommodations in order to prove discrimination. A family who had sued the district, the Oseo Area School District near Minneapolis, argued that federal law required merely that the school display deliberate indifference, a lower standard. The two sides had argued in front of lower courts over the legal standard in schools. But in recent court filings, the school district argued that the higher standard could apply broadly to all sorts of disability rights claims under the Rehabilitation Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. That unnerved some disability rights groups, who warned that if the court accepted the school district's argument, the higher bad faith standard could make it much harder for Americans with disabilities to successfully bring court challenges. The school district's position led to an unusually tense oral argument, with lawyers for the family and the federal government arguing that the district had improperly shifted its position after the justices had agreed to hear the case. The lawyer for the school district rejected those claims, going so far as to suggest that her opponents were lying, an accusation that prompted a rebuke from one of the justices. The case, AJT versus Oseo Area Schools, number 24-249, stemmed from a dispute over whether the Minnesota school district provided reasonable accommodations for Ava Tharp, a teenage girl with severe epilepsy that made it difficult for her to attend school during normal hours. The girl's family said they had requested evening instruction, but were told the district would not provide it, leaving Ava with only 65% of the instructional hours that her peers received. After the district rejected the Tharp family's request for evening instruction, the family filed a complaint with the Minnesota Department of Education. An administrative law judge found that the school district had violated federal law, ruling that the district's prevailing and paramount consideration was not Ava's need for instruction, but rather the school system's desire to maintain the regular hours of the school's faculty. The dispute then moved to federal court, where a trial judge sided in part with the school district, finding that under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act, the Tharp family was required to show the school district had acted with either bad faith or gross misjudgment. A panel of judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit agreed. In front of the Supreme Court, the two sides argued over both the standard that should be required to prove discrimination in schools and whether that standard should be applied in other settings. The lawyer for the student and her family, Roman Martinez, argued that the school district's line of reasoning would revolutionize disability law, stripping protections from vulnerable victims and gutting the reasonable accommodations needed for equal opportunities. A federal government lawyer, Nicole F. Reeves, assistant to the Solicitor General, appeared to agree, calling the district's position breathtakingly broad. The lawyer for the school district, Lisa S. Blatt, argued that, for schools, the bad faith standard was proper. She said lowering the bar for proving discrimination would be costly for school districts and could even jeopardize federal funding if it was determined that schools had failed to comply with federal law. Ms. Blatt argued that a ruling against the school district would expose 46,000 public schools to liability when, for 40 years, they have trained teachers, allocated budgets, and obtained insurance all in reliance on the bad faith standard. Every good faith disagreement would risk liability or even the nuclear option, the loss of federal funding, which is over $100 billion, she said. Ms. Blatt conceded that her argument meant that this higher standard could apply to disability cases that do not involve public schools, potentially heightening the legal standard for all disability rights cases. Some of the justices appeared incredulous. "Your argument is that bad faith should apply everywhere?" asked Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. When Ms. Blatt answered yes, Justice Amy Coney Barrett jumped in. "That would be a sea change, right?" Justice Barrett asked. "Well, it would be only a sea change in terms of liability," Ms. Blatt responded. "A sea change in terms of liability is a pretty big sea change," Justice Barrett answered. Ms. Blatt said it was not true that the school district had shifted its position, going so far as to say the accusation was a lie and inaccurate. That upended the normal decorum of the court, where advocates often use the term friend to refer to their opponents. "You believe that Mr. Martinez and the Solicitor General are lying?" Justice Neil M. Gorsuch said. "Is that your accusation?" "At oral argument, yes, absolutely," Ms. Blatt responded. "It is not true that we," Justice Gorsuch broke in before she finished, saying, "I think you should be more careful with your words, Ms. Blatt." "Okay, well, they should be more careful in mischaracterizing a position by an experienced advocate of the Supreme Court, with all due respect," she said. Justice Gorsuch returned to the point later in the argument, asking Ms. Blatt to withdraw her accusation. After an extended back and forth, she agreed. Justice Sonia Sotomayor also expressed concern over the school district's position. She suggested Ms. Blatt might have violated a court rule that obligates lawyers to point out any perceived misstatements of law or facts in briefs, arguing that the court should not hear a case. Ms. Blatt said the school system had not argued that point, but said failing to do so did not violate court rules because it had not been necessary, given the school district had merely been required in its filings to defend its win in the lower appeals court. A decision in the case is expected by the end of the court's term, which typically concludes in late June or early July. This next article comes from the Disability Scoop. It's entitled "Congress Weighs Drastic Cuts to Medicaid Disability Services" by Michelle Diament, April 28, 2025. The future of the nation's disability services is on the line, advocates say, as Congress reconvenes to consider legislation that would chop billions from Medicaid. Earlier this month, the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives approved a Republican-backed budget blueprint with leaders eyeing $1.5 trillion in savings over 10 years. The blueprint does not specify what programs would be cut, but it calls for the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which oversees Medicaid, to find at least $880 billion in savings. Now, members of Congress will get to work on crafting a bill detailing exactly how they will make that happen, and disability advocates are bracing for a fight. "We are deeply concerned that Medicaid will be targeted, putting critical services for individuals with autism and developmental disabilities at severe risk," said Christopher Banks, president and CEO of the Autism Society of America. "Cuts of this magnitude could dismantle decades of progress in community-based care, leaving families without access to therapies, residential supports, and essential health care." While President Donald Trump and other Republicans have said they won't target Medicaid, it's unclear how lawmakers could achieve the level of savings called for without cutting the program. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office found that when Medicare is excluded, Medicaid accounts for 93% of mandatory spending under the House Energy and Commerce Committee's purview. What's more, the office concluded that the committee is expected to oversee only $581 billion in spending outside of Medicare and Medicaid, meaning that there is no way to achieve $880 billion in cuts without touching either of the health programs. The prospect of deep cuts to Medicaid has even some Republicans concerned. We cannot and will not support a final reconciliation bill that includes any reduction in Medicaid coverage for vulnerable populations, a dozen House Republicans wrote in a recent letter to congressional leadership. For people with disabilities, the stakes are especially high, advocates say. The Medicaid home and community-based services system serves as the backbone of support for people with developmental disabilities in this country, and it is already under tremendous strain. Over 700,000 people are on waiting lists for Medicaid waivers, which provide home and community-based services, according to KFF, a nonprofit that conducts health policy research, and even those with waivers have struggled to get supports in recent years. A national survey of nearly 500 community-based service providers released in December found that almost all had faced moderate or severe staffing shortages in the previous year. As a result, 69% had declined new clients and 39% closed programs or services, with over a third saying they were considering further cuts. Home and community-based services are particularly vulnerable to any funding changes, advocates say, because they are considered optional Medicaid offerings under federal law. Cuts of this magnitude would force states to make harmful decisions, such as lowering provider payment rates, eliminating optional benefits, or restricting eligibility, said Kim Machino, Senior Director of Medicaid Policy at the ARC of the United States. Any reductions to this essential program risk undermining the ability of individuals with IDD to live with dignity in their communities. Services such as dental care, transportation, and respite are not luxuries. They are fundamental to quality of life. Cutting them would place unsustainable strain on families, direct support professionals, and state systems already stretched thin. Heather Sachs, co-director of policy and advocacy at the National Down Syndrome Congress, is warning that lawmakers are looking to act quickly. Congress is moving fast and lives are on the line, she said. We're in a fight for survival. The House Energy and Commerce Committee is set to begin markup on May 7th, and these next few weeks are critical. We're mobilizing across the country to make sure our voices are heard before it's too late. That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening to the Disability News Program, and thanks for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.